everybody, to another episode of Passports, Please. Conversations about the power of place, the places that change us, and why it matters. And our very, very special guest this morning is Mary Gaucher, who is just an internationally known singer-songwriter, award-winning in every category you can imagine. And one of the reasons we want to talk to you this morning, Mary, is our theme about the power of place. I'm very struck about what I read about your life and what you were doing. And then there was this defining moment, and all of a sudden, it sounds like it was all of a sudden, the power of the song called to you. So would you mind backing us up a little bit and telling us how you got to that pivotal place?
Yeah. Thanks for asking. And thanks for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be with you today. God, my story is so long now. I got to condense it here. I struggled from a very early age with drugs and alcohol. I definitely am an alcoholic and an addict. And I'm one of those addictive types who, from the very beginning, from my very first drink, fire water. I was in my first rehab when I was 15 years old. I got sober when I was 28. After I got sober, it was like coming out of a coma in a way. Mm-hmm. And I looked around me and realized I was running a restaurant next door to Berklee College of Music, that I was surrounded by musicians and songwriters and music.
Speaking of grace.
Sort of, yeah. Diagonally across the street from, wow, Symphony Hall in Boston. And it's like, wow, musicians everywhere, music everywhere. And I didn't have a clue that mattered or was relevant to me yet. I hadn't written a song. I hadn't been out in the music world at all, except occasionally as a fan.
Yeah. So you got started late in life with music. So even you didn't even have any, I guess, desire or interest at all when you were younger. It
found you.
Found you later on, right?
Yeah, I mean, I may have had desire and interest, but I didn't have the ability to pursue it because I was an alcoholic and an addict, and I couldn't focus, and I also didn't have the self-esteem, the courage, which is a strange thing to say, given that we know so many artists find courage in drugs and alcohol. I wasn't one of them.
Really?
There was no way I could do it until I got myself together. But a couple of years into recovery, sober, one of my waitresses brought me to an open mic where she proceeded to perform a song of hers on stage in Cambridge at Club Passim, which is an old folk club. And for me, it was a light bulb screwing in. It was like I could hear the angels sing almost. I'm not sure that's exactly what happened, but now that I've told this story for 35 years, I think maybe something like that may be a little exaggerated. But
don't let the truth get in the way of a good story.
There was a moment when I saw her transform from a waitress, somewhat clumsy, definitely not a career restaurant person, just someone holding down a job to pay the rent. You know, most people in the restaurant business where I was working were passing through. And so she wasn't a professional waitress. She was a songwriter. And when I saw her transform on stage to this poised, beautiful, powerful, confident songwriter behind a keyboard who just knew how to do that, I was amazed at her transformation. And something just inside me said, that's what I want to do. I want to get on that stage and sing an original song. I had never written a song. I did have a guitar, you know, I had attempted to write songs a lot when I was using drugs and alcohol, thinking, you know, if I got the right chemicals together in the right order, I would become a songwriter. It was a really delusional, immature, ridiculous process that never worked.
Yeah. Did any of the, none of those songs ever worked?
I never, they weren't even songs. They were like, scribblings on paper that I threw away. I didn't have the skills or the, I didn't have the, confidence to finish anything. I mean, I could finish, I could run a restaurant. I could get people to invest in my business ideas, but I couldn't write a song. I couldn't be an artist. But after I saw Christy on that stage, I just knew that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to get on that stage and play a song. So I had an old guitar. I restrung it. I started building calluses on my fingers. I was newly sober, too. So in early sobriety, in early recovery, a day feels like 100 years. Time drags. It astonished me that a day was so long. When I was drinking, I worked and then I drank. When I got sober, I worked and then I didn't know what the hell to do. So I threw myself into songwriting and eventually did play a song on that stage and started going to the open mic regularly there, discovered other open mics, discovered a community of songwriters in Boston, acquainted myself with the lifestyle of a songwriter. And really fell in love with it. And it took 10 years. I guess I was probably, 28 when I got sober. I moved to Nashville, when I was 40. So it was a process more than an event. I slowly became, I guess committed to giving this my best shot, not knowing if that would, you know, be the end of me or if I would go broke or if, I mean, I didn't have any idea if I could pull this off. It was a risk. I had a very secure job owning the restaurant. The paychecks came, but I wasn't happy. It really wasn't what I was supposed to be doing. I loved it in the beginning. I grew to hate it, and I just wanted to write songs. And so at a certain point, it just became clear, I got to go. And I knew I had to come to Nashville.
What was the bridge between that moment of awareness when you watched your friend on stage and you said, that's what I want to do, and writing that first song that you knew was a, quote, real song?
I would say probably a couple of months. I didn't know about open mics or this opportunity to play original songs in front of an audience, how any of that worked. So I had to learn about all that. I started going back. It's on Monday nights, every Monday night, you pay $5. They put your name in a hat, and you get this time slot you get. People play two songs. So I just kept going back, watching how it worked, getting familiar with people that were regulars, going back home and working on my song, till eventually the day came where I felt I was ready to put my name in the hat. You know, the experience was terrifying. I was horrible, and thank God there were no cell phones to record the dreadful moment of my debut. The seas didn't part. There wasn't a standing ovation. Mostly I felt like I was in mortal danger of dying up there. I was panicked. It was terrible. I was absolutely terrified, and it took years. I mean, years to not be terrified.
Yeah, it's interesting. I still keep thinking about how you're talking about, you know, you couldn't do this when you were drinking, and it took you, you know, to to quit to be able to do this. And I'm, yeah, like I said, I couldn't imagine getting up on stage without some alcohol in my body to, you know, just
right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's yeah. That, and that, yeah, that's gotta be nerve wracking to,
oh, it's terrifying.
Yeah. You've got nothing that's, you know, your mask or whatever to, you know, to calm you down. So how long did it take before you started seeing, you know, getting a positive response and getting, you know, recognition and going, okay, this is working for me?
God, you know.
Because, I mean, seems like you had a pretty quick success with all this, or was it the 10-year overnight success?
I think it, for me, it was a lot. It was, well, first of all, because I was older than the people, most people don't start doing this at 40. I mean, there's a weirdness to that, but there's also an advantage to that because I'd owned a business. I knew how business worked. I knew how relationships worked. I knew that you needed to have relationships in business for the business to work. I knew that, you know, quickly I got myself onto the board of Club Passim. You know, I'm playing open mics, but because of owning a restaurant and having a resume as a, you know, as an entrepreneur in Boston, I could get on the board. And positioning myself on the board put me in a place to meet the owners of Rounder Records. So I was able to move behind the scenes quickly because I know how business works. But that doesn't mean that my songs are good enough to get a record deal on Rounder Records. You can position yourself all you want, but you've got to have the songs.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to do both pretty quickly. I learned early on that the number of people that I know that are in the field that I want to be in matters, that I have to reach out and get in relationships with people and help other people. The more people you help, the more goodwill you create for yourself.
Which you're doing a lot of too.
Yeah, you know, and that's also a mainstay of recovery. One of the great things about recovery, if you're in a 12-step program, is you learn how to be of service. And that's not something most self-centered addicts and alcoholics can think up on their own. It's a mandate of recovery to be in service. You learn early on to help other alcoholics and addicts, and then you bring it out into the world and try to serve where you can, when you can. Why do you do that? Because it makes you happy. Also, it helps you stay sober. It creates purpose and it gives meaning to life. I mean, every spiritual practice there is teaches love and service. It's part of a strategy to be in this world that works in terms of finding purpose and learning how to be in relationships that are sustainable over time. But I went pretty quickly up the ladder, I guess. It didn't feel like it to me at the time.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, I couldn't really get people's attention in Boston very well. I felt there was a prejudice against people from the South, but then there is. There's sort of an assumption of ignorance or stupidity or racism or stereotypes. I got my first booking agent and he kept telling me, you got to get out of there. You got to get out of there. There's product confusion. You know, you're a Southern artist and you're in New England. It doesn't make sense. You're not a New England folk singer. I can't pitch you as a New England folk singer. Those New England clubs will book you if you don't live there. And he was right. He was right. So I got back to the South in 2001, and it really opened up for me. He was very right.
Mary, you mentioned when you first got up on that stage, how terrifying it was. As an audience member and a fan of your music, I have to admit, maybe it's not terrifying, but when I'm listening to your music intentionally, which is the only way I can listen to it, I know, not with terror, but I know there is a place that you're going to take me, talk about the power of place. There's just a total no bullshit, honest, authentic, you got to listen to this because it makes me look at myself experience. And I'm thinking that was probably true from the beginning because that is so much your, I hate this word, your brand, what people expect from you, even when we're afraid to get it, if that makes any sense. Has that always been how you approached your songwriting? There's such utter, utter no bullshit to it that it's a little intimidating to listen to.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yes, it took me a while to understand that that is what was being asked of me. And I had to go through some layers to find my voice as a songwriter, what it was that I was going to do as a songwriter. But once I found it, I stay with it, and I still do. For me, I see my relationship with the song and the audience as a sacred trust. And for me, it has everything to do with integrity. And so because my integrity is on the line every time I stand in front of an audience, I'm either going to stand up there and be as honest as I have the capability of being, or I'm not going to do it. And that's often off-putting and scary for some people who aren't used to being around that definition of integrity. But it works for me. And I think it's also tied to the fact that I have to hold myself to certain standards to stay sober. And so I just believe that I am on a search for truth, a search for beauty, a search for what it means to be alive in the moment I'm writing in, what the experience is to be Mary Gaucher, to be a member of the human race, you know, on whatever day I'm today, if I write October 27th, 2020, what is it? What are you experiencing? And where does that experience connect with all the other souls who are experiencing this in this time? And so I want to document and chronicle my time and our time. And that's the most I think a writer can do, is bring you truth of the time. And I like to do it from the emotional experience. I'm not a journalist. I don't need to stick to the facts, but I do need to stick to the truth, which is tricky. And I teach songwriting quite a bit. And this is something a lot of my writers stumble over. They tell me, I tell them, I don't believe that line you just wrote. And they say, but it happened. And I say that is not the way to determine whether a line is true. It has to be believable on an emotional level. I have to buy in emotionally and feel it. So I just see the work of the artist, particularly songwriter, as building bridges between souls, and it's empathy that we're building. I'm just firm in that I do see the work is built on empathy and bringing the listener into the experience of someone else in such a deep way that they experience it as their own experience for those 3 minutes and 45 seconds.
And that builds such trust, you know, again, speaking as a listener, that builds such trust in that relationship that I know when I listen to you or I go to hear you, even if it's it's a little uncomfortable because that's the passageway for me to get to my truth, that little bit of discomfort. And that just builds complete and utter trust in that relationship.
Yeah, and I think that's, you can trust someone who has integrity. You know they're not going to come at you with a completely different personality at 9 o'clock than they had at 6 o'clock.
Well, they may, but you wouldn't know it.
So.
Yeah.
So, well, Mary, you know, you talk about how part of your healing has been helping other people, and of course, you know, you're doing your songwriting workshops, and you're doing a lot with soldiers coming home, and you've got some amazing stories that you've told, and you've even done your own album from these songs that you've written with these soldiers.
Yeah. They carry tremendous stories. Think of Tim O'Brien's book, The Things They Carried. They carry incredible, incredible stories. I got into it through Darden Smith, who founded a program called Songwriting with Soldiers.
He founded that?
He founded it.
Okay. And what's it called again for our listeners?
Songwriting with Soldiers. It's a nonprofit. It's based in Nashville now, and I think Darden's sort of taking a step back and passing the torch on to the next generation of people who will be running it. But I got invited to be a part of it about 8-9 years ago, something like that. And I've stayed with it. I did a retreat with them on Zoom this Saturday, writing with veterans. I really, really like writing with veterans. I really like much to my surprise, and I don't mean this in a nasty way, but much to my surprise, I have a lot in common with people who've served. I'm a leftist, lesbian, hippie who is anti-war.
I'll salute that. Yeah.
This is my favorite story of yours.
Politics of the NRA and the god awfulness of the administrations that keep getting us into endless wars for reasons even the soldiers don't understand. So I'm figuring, this is probably not a match made in heaven. It turns out those are stereotypes, and I am doing the stereotyping. I love our veterans. I have never done a retreat in the 9 years that I've been a part of the program where I didn't find commonalities that go to the very core of who I am with veterans. And it's just every single time an incredibly beautiful experience to bear witness to their stories and help them articulate what they're going through. And I love them. You got to understand too, these are volunteers. We've had a volunteer military for a very long time, since the Vietnam War. So these people signed up voluntarily to serve. Some do it out of just a sincere desire to be of service. Some do it out of desperation because there's no jobs in their town. Some do it to get out of a family life that's just brutal and unbearable. I worked with a woman on Saturday who enlisted at 17. And her 18th birthday was her first day at Fort Dix. What I do is I sit with them. I bear witness to their story. We find a through line that we can turn into a song, and together we put the song into some shape, and it's co-write. I'm the songwriter, but they've got the story, so I just keep saying, does this feel right, does this sound right, does this feel right, is this what you went through, is this right? And they say yes or they say no, and we just keep going till we get the song. It takes about 2 hours or so, 2.5, and we have one.
And what's the impact on a soldier or a veteran? They go, it's not just a song, it's the experience with you of the writing process, and then all of a sudden what didn't exist before now exists, and it's deeply personal and probably very, very helpful.
Well, I think you've said you've literally saved some lives from this you know, working with these people and getting their stories out and feeling like, you know, they're being heard finally.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it exactly like that. I would say that the songs have saved some lives because that's what the veterans have told us, that they were planning. Several have said, look, I didn't want to tell you when we were working, but I was planning to take myself out. And somehow through this process of writing this song, I've decided to keep going. And see what happens, and it goes back to empathy. What happens is when you feel seen and heard and known and accepted, you don't want to kill yourself anymore. There's a resonance that puts you back into the tribe. It's the removal that makes you want to die. And of course, trauma is removal. Trauma, something happened that is so utterly ineffable, there's no words for it, that you can't explain how you feel or what happened. And that inability to articulate your pain is a removal. And the sense that no one knows and no one understands and I can't explain it is a burden, and it gets bigger over time, not smaller. And songs are an incredible place to find a way to articulate that ineffable pain. And music can get there. Music can get there in ways that no other thing can reach. And so if I can just get the melody to their emotions and put a few true words in it, amazing things can happen. But it's not me doing it. It's the power of music and song that does this. You've got to be willing to go there with them, and you've got to be willing to truly get yourself out of the way and really listen to what they're saying, and help pull the poison out by listening and bearing witness. And it is an incredible process. It's almost in some ways I feel like a priest sometimes, like it's a confessional. The music opens them up, and they say things like, I've not told my wife this. No one knows this. I've not told anyone. And they tell the songwriter, because the music and the song is the right place to unload. You know, Darden always used to say, and I think he's right, songs are where we tell secrets. You know, you're at a party, you know, and you're talking and you're mingling. And somebody says, how you doing? You don't come back with, I'm so lonesome, I could cry. You know, it's just not, it doesn't work that way. But, you know, you sit down to write. And, yeah, you sit down to write a song, and that's exactly where you put it. And then you sing it, and everybody who's ever been that lonesome goes, me too. And it works. And that's the beauty of song.
Yeah, you're making me want to start writing songs now. I just turned 50. It's not too late, is it?
it's never too late.
Well, Mary, I wrote my first song at 65.
You know, as long as you have a heart and you can feel, and you can write. You can write songs, yeah. Absolutely.
And I can't imagine my life 7 years after I wrote my first song, as not having that in my life, having that place to go to place for that secret. And so many times, I don't even know what the secret really is until I start writing.
Well, that's it. It becomes a scavenger hunt to what the hell is going on. And that's why it's transformative, because it can help you articulate in a tangible way that other people can understand something that you didn't even understand going into the song.
Well, and if
it takes it from, yeah, the ethereal sort of inside your brain and nobody else can see it and you can't really make sense of it because it's floating around with a billion other thoughts, it turns it into something tangible.
And the first time I experienced that with your music is that song, That's How You Learn to Live Alone. Mm-hmm. We have a friend, you probably know Nathan Brown, who's doing an almost daily series called Man, That Poem Killed Me. Well, if you had a show called Man, that Song Almost Killed Me and Saved Me, that would certainly be on my list because of every single word hitting me, making up a larger truth that I really had not been able to articulate. So thank you for that. A little personal side note, but it's exactly what you're talking about.
First you fall, then you fly, and you believe that you belong up in the sky. Flap your arms as you run. Every revolution brings you closer to the sun. You fall asleep in motion in uncharted hemispheres, and wake up with the stars falling down around your ears. When they hit the ground, they're nothing but stone. That's how you learn to live alone. It's how you learn to live alone. Bit by bit, you slip away. You lose yourself in pieces in the things you don't say. You're not here, still there. The sun goes up, the sun goes down, and you're not sure you care. You live inside the false till you don't recognize the truth. People send you pictures and you can't believe it's you. It's been years since your house has felt like home. That's how you learn to live alone. That's how you learn to live alone. It don't feel right, but it's not wrong. Start again this far along. Brick by brick, the letting go. As you walk away from everything you know, you release resistance. Thank you.
And speaking of song, and this is a little bit off of quote tape here, Rodney and I were thinking we'd like to insert a couple of your songs during this period, and we have a couple we've thought of, but we're wondering if there are one or two in particular that you wouldn't mind sharing on this podcast and what they would be, or if you want to think about it, or something that top of mind.
Oh, just... you guys, you know what you're aiming for. I mean, I'd be honored to have anything that you like on there. It'd be wonderful for me.
Yeah, for me, the obvious is, you know, and if, you know, your fan base, it's, you know, it's your main, I guess it's almost your anthem, I guess, is Mercy Now.
Yeah. But
for, you know, our listeners that don't know you yet, you know, I think that's a great intro to you. And that's one of yours that just, it seems to
get
popping up
more timely every day.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just, in fact, the moment when I saw it on Yellowstone last year, I had no idea that was coming.
Yeah, that was a heck of a placement.
Yeah. What was the process for that?
I don't know. It just happened and the check came.
You just got, or did you even get a call that it was going to be there? Or?
The woman who administers my publishing said they asked for it. I didn't know the show or what it meant, or, you know, my songs keep putting a lot of stuff and I don't know how they're going to use it or where they're going to use it. And I don't pay a lot of attention to it because it doesn't happen. There was a slight little discussion. She negotiated a fee with them. I just said, take care of it. And then fast forward a year and suddenly my phone blew up. Like, oh my God, they played 2 or 3 minutes of your song at the very end of the season. It's like, Jesus Christ, I'm in tears. And it's like, oh, cool. I forgot about that.
But it was such a perfect placement. I mean, the lyrics went with the storyline. It's like you wrote that song for that episode.
Yeah, they did a fine job with that. That just is so hard in television because they mostly don't want songs with – they write the words, you know. They're the writers. They just want background music or something that sets a mood. They don't want a story, which is, you know, makes perfect sense. So that was just a match that was once in a lifetime probably.
Hmm. Would you mind backing up and giving us the – experience of writing that song? What might have prompted it at that particular moment?
Well, yeah, that song was written after 9/11. Bush was president. It was clear that after 9/11 he was going to bring us to a war that I vehemently opposed in Iraq. I knew that the goodwill, you know, as a citizen of the world, as most troubadours are, I travel, well, before COVID, I constantly outside of the United States, and I felt the goodwill and I felt the empathy and the, you know, the positive vibes of, we're so sorry for what happened on 9/11. He's going to turn that into anti-American, hatred, really. I just didn't, I wasn't, and I'm still not, sold on, the war in Iraq. And, my father at the same time was, slipping away. He, was no longer able to recognize us, and, he was fading out. There was a giant scandal with the Catholic clergy in the Boston area as well during that time, where over 100 priests were arrested for the sexual impropriety with children. And all of these things were colliding at the same time that the dictator of North Korea's father was testing nuclear weapons. At that time, that's who was in charge up there. All these things were happening simultaneously, and they became the backbone of this song that is a plea for mercy.
And this song can be applied to every other thing that's happened since then. It's just,
it's a timeless song. Yeah, it opened up way bigger than the specifics. And one of the things I did on purpose was try to stay away from the exact, I didn't want to get into, again, journalism. I just wanted to get to the emotional truth of what was happening, which I think was a wise decision as a songwriter. So those events aren't even mentioned, but that's what was going in the background.
And again, for me, when I first heard it was exactly the time that my father was in his last days. So I zero in on that, and then I go out to the bigger, more universal themes, which, you know, is first of all brilliant songwriting. Thank you, and just had such a huge impact to help me get through some things.
Yeah, last year when I was coming home from Africa, you know, we came through Istanbul and spent 3 days there, and we were down on the water, and there was this graffiti that somebody had done. Of course, you know, we're in Turkey, but it was in English, and it said "Mercy Now." And I've got a photo of it. I've been meaning to send it to you, Mary.
Wow!
But I the second I saw that, I was like, I wonder, you know, if that person that did that knows your song, or if it was just totally random, or. But,
wow, yeah. That's incredible! Yeah. That's incredible.
My father could use a little mercy now. The fruits of his labor falling right slowly on the ground. His work is almost over. It won't be long. He won't be around. I love my father. He could use some mercy now. My brother could use a little mercy now. He's a stranger to freedom. He's shackled to his fear and his doubt. The pain that he lives in, it's almost more than living will allow. I love my brother. He could use some mercy now. My church and my country could use a little mercy now. As they sink into a poison pit, it's gonna take forever to climb out. They carry the weight of the faithful who follow them down. I love my church and country. They could use some mercy now. Every living thing could use a little mercy now. Only the hand of grace can end the race towards another mushroom cloud. People in power, they'll do anything to keep their crown. I love life and life itself. Some mercy now. could you a little mercy now? I know we don't deserve it, but we need it anyhow. We hang in the balance, dangle between hell and hallowed ground. And every single one of us could use some mercy now. Every single one of us could use some mercy now. Every single one of us could use some mercy now.
I also know that another form that your writing takes and your stories takes are actual written short stories, and that you've been published. And tell us a little bit about that part of your creative writing life, and when does something need to be a song and when does it need to be a short story?
Yeah, the honest answer is that it needs to be a short story when a publisher says, I'll pay you to write one.
Yeah. Bingo. See, there's that truth again, Rodney. Yeah. You can't get away from it.
The writing literature, writing stories for a publication is very, very, very difficult. And I'm a student of it still, for sure. I just completed a book in the shutdown in the early part of the pandemic, and that's coming out in July of 2021, this coming up July. It's called Saved by a Song, and it's a discussion of a bit of a memoir, a bit of a discussion of my take on songwriting, a bit of philosophy of art, the transformative nature of song as I see it applied to trauma, particularly my own. So it's a mashup of a book, but I did, in retrospect, enjoy completing it. No, I can't say writing it. Writing it's hell and hard, but completing it, I got this sense of, you know, I got to do this again. So maybe I am pivoting in a way towards, I seem to have already pitched the publisher another idea. She was like, yes, it'd be great to have that in the queue for after this other book hits. I like short form writing. I tend to be better at being concise, but long form is calling to me. I don't know what that's going to lead to. I do enjoy reading. I'm an avid reader. My house is just floor to ceiling books everywhere. I really have always been a reader since I was a little kid. I remember going to the bookmobile on Saturdays in Baton Rouge and getting in the line, and they only let you have five. So you had to pick the five that mattered, because that truck wasn't coming back for a week. I remember it was a very, very big decision. I love language of words, and I love communicating through the careful application of words. So
have you ever thought about publishing your reading list, or, you know, the top 10 things I've been reading in lockdown?
You know, I mean, I'm sure
personally,
that's
I would
probably
love to see what's on that.
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably coming. I mean, working with a book publisher is a new experience for me. And I can imagine that they're going to be asking me to do stuff like that. Like, right now I'm reading the story of Rainer Maria Rilke and Auguste Rodin.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Rilke and Rodin were friends.
I did not know that.
It's called You Must Change Your Life. And I love this book. Well, the next book I want to write is kind of a play on the Rilke book, Letters to a Young Poet. So I'm taking questions on my website, Ask Mary. And I just want people to bombard me with questions. And
is
I'll
that
try
the
to
website
write,
or there's an Ask Mary on your website?
On my website, yeah. It's called Mary's Mercy Missives. I just want to be bombarded with questions, and I'll try to write honest answers and turn that into a manuscript.
This could be
brilliant.
Fun.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. But Rilke and we could do a whole nother conversation about that. Yeah. So of people and writing that has changed my life. So, well, that's brilliant. I just wrote that down. I'll be on maybe not Amazon, but the Book People in Austin, and have them order it for me.
Yeah, you know, I think you'll love this book. First of all, I didn't know that Rilke was only 27 when he wrote the letters to the young poet.
Yikes.
I get the feeling, you know, when you read it, that he was an older artist writing
that.
Well, you know, he was 27. So this is a really interesting behind the scenes look at Rilke before he wrote the letters to young poet, and his relationship with the great artist Rodin. Mm. So, I'm always exploring this kind of stuff to try to I have to stay engaged to with language to be able to continue to write.
Right. Yeah.
You know, when songwriters say, I don't know what to say. I don't have anything to write about. I'm empty. Like, well, go read. Go to the local bookstore and get 20 books.
Yeah.
Close your fucking iPhone and turn off your computer and read 10 of them over the next week.
Or sit in a coffee shop and just listen. Just
that too.
Listen. And these fragments. Some people kid me about what I call my hook book. And because I know I hear something, I just write it down. I don't have anything to do with it right now, but that's just a great collection of words that I don't want to lose. And
that's true. You want to hear some good stories, go to AA.
Of course, you can't publish any of them. But
oh, sure you can. You take phrases. I got a song called I Drink. It came right out of an AA meeting. Right out of an AA meeting.
Really?
Yeah, an old guy. Yeah, an old guy told a young guy, fish swim, birds fly, drunks drink.
Wow.
Yeah, and of course you're in pain. You're not drinking. You got to have to get used to going against your nature.
Yeah.
And that's why we have to come to these meetings to help each other do such a thing. It's like asking a fish not to swim. I wrote that right now.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, it's gotten so that I have friends that call me up or text me, and they'll be out somewhere, and they say, "Oh, we just came up with a great line. You're going to want to love this." It's like, "Yep, give it to me."
There have been so many in this conversation.
Oh,
where
I know,
just...
and I write everything down, Rodney. You know that. So. Yeah.
Well, it's a life's work, isn't it? Once you get into the mindset of I'm a songwriter, or like Rodney, I'm a photographer. Mm. You see pictures everywhere.
Right.
You see songs everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, see, just the way that the red leaves are hanging off the tree in front of my window right now. It's a very particular thing. They look sad. You know, it's a gray day. It's there's a sorrow in that tree, and it's letting go. And I can see the metaphor for what we're going through right now as a people, that we're, even if we win, according to my calculations, even if we win the election, of course, I'm for Biden. We're going to be grieving, and a victory will not take away the grief. It will be a celebration of sorts, but we have a lot to deal with. And so, you know, if you just look around, there it is, it's there.
And like that leaf, some of us are just hanging on, barely hanging on for now. So.
Yeah. And a lot of us won't be, well, you know, if the numbers are right, we're going to see the number of dead that have already died. It's going to double by the end of the year. I mean, we're in November almost.
Yeah,
that's a massive, massive number of deaths in a short period of time. I hope they're wrong, but I don't have any evidence to see that they are wrong.
And so your work and work of the artists, photographers, writers, musicians, visual artists is to explore that hope that still hopefully lingers somewhere in all of us during these incredibly difficult times. I get hope from your writing. I get hope from Rodney's photographs, for sure, for our experiences that we have with these conversations in this podcast. I think it's interesting, Rodney, that we talked about doing this for about 2 years. It was actually after one of the songwriter retreats at Blue Rock, and Rodney and I were like having that, you know, last drink and came up with this great idea, but we didn't really do anything until the lockdown. Yeah. Until we were like, well, we run out of excuses.
Yeah, I can't go anywhere. We're stuck at home, yeah. So let's do something.
And it's been such a blessing, and it feels like a creative thing that we can do collectively.
What has that been like for you, Mary? Since this big pause, have you been writing more, or how have you switched since all this? You know, because you're doing a lot from home and doing your weekly show on, you know, with your videos but have you been creating more since all this?
Is there any difference?
Because it's been stifling for me, because I, you know, obviously my stuff is travel. I need to go be in nature and be with big animals. And, yeah. You know, I've resorted to photographing squirrels and birds and rabbits in my backyard. You know?
Yeah. And they're lovely photographs, honey. They are. Don't shortchange yourself.
I mean, I'm writing songs. I finished a book. I want to start working on the next one. I think the big change for me is this sense of awe in my ability, in our ability, to accept the unimaginable. Like, okay, in an instant, it's all gone. Your whole year is wiped out. You've worked 30 years to get to the summer and spring that you were about to have after a Grammy nomination. I was flying high, and I had real money coming and big gigs all over the world. And it was an exciting time. And within 48 hours, gone. And for some reason, I'm okay. It's like, oh, okay. We won't be doing that. We'll be doing something else. Like, and I wasn't kicking and screaming. I wasn't angry or cursing God. I didn't even grieve. Like, it's like, oh, okay. You won't be doing that. You'll be doing something else. You'll be able to, you know, figure that out one day at a time, like you've been doing your life all along. And I'm kind of amazed at, and I continue to be amazed at, well, this could go on another year.
I was saying about that this morning. It, for some reason, that hit me. And yeah, this really could go on for another year or two.
And so I am stunned at my ability, and I'm actually quite at peace with living under the unknown question mark of when this. I guess I'm kind of in awe at the resilience of the human animal and my own resilience. Like, okay, well, if we can't do that, then we'll do this and just shift on over. So suddenly I'm teaching online. Suddenly I'm hiking 5 miles every day in this really hilly park that is quite challenging. Taking guitar lessons online. I'm able to find peace and fulfillment once it was clear that this is real and this ain't going away. We just managed to keep. I mean, I guess this was what it was like for people making tea in the Blitz in London. Like, okay, my house is in rubble, but I still have a kettle. I just get some way to heat the water, and I'm going to make a tea. I'm going to sit on the stone that used to be my home and see if anybody has a cup, and we're going to like that's what we do. And it's really amazing. It's really amazing to have a massive interruption, and then just keep going.
Yeah, as bad as it's been, it's on many other levels. It has been a good thing. And the part that I think about, especially if this does go on for another year, you know, everybody talks about wanting to get back to normal. I don't know that we ever will.
Or were.
So it's, yeah.
I think we know for sure that when we emerge, it will not be the same. Certainly for musicians, the venues that we've known and loved our entire careers, half of them will be gone. They can't survive years without income. They're gonna shut. It's over. They're gonna go bankrupt. We're gonna emerge to a different world. We're not going backwards. We're going forwards. So we'll see what's out there once we emerge. And there's literally no clue as to when that will be. And so we wait, and I'm not miserable. I do miss traveling. I do miss the life that I had because I really loved it.
Yeah, that's the best way to put it. Yeah, I'm not miserable. I'm not sad, depressed. I just kind of miss some things.
Me too. Me too. I miss it, but I'm okay today. You know, I got a student at noon, a co-write at 1:30. And then I'm going to go hike. I'm going to have a good day. And that's kind of amazing.
Well, and while we wait, we do get to wait with the beautiful art that you have made and continue to make with your music and your writing. And we are both just so grateful that we have that resource and that we have had this time with you. It's just been an incredible, I'll use the word blessing, overused these days, I think, but truly is, and to really have conversations with love and hope and creativity is not a bad thing.
Yeah, it's a good pivot. We pivot to love. What's wrong with that?
Not a thing.
There's another song.
There's another song. Okay. All right. I'll arm wrestle you for the hook, Mary. Unless you've already written
yours.
It.
Go write.
I got a tree to write about. Hang on.
We do want to thank you so much. We're just, we've just been filled to the brim with your conversation, our conversation, and look forward to every new thing that's coming out of all of this, this creativity and the unknowns. And just want to say thank you.
And I'd also, yeah, it's a pleasure. Thanks for bringing me on, and good luck with this project. I think it's a wonderful idea, and I wish you great success.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, we'd also like to thank our producer, Brock Glenn Thomas, who gets us out of a lot of trouble almost weekly. We want to thank Donovan Frankenreiter for our intro and outro music, and we'd like to thank Rupert Neve Design for our studio equipment. It all goes into helping us do what we are so loving doing. And I am Chick Morgan, the Cowgirl Diva, your co-host. And
I'm Rodney Bersiel,
the photographer in chief. So we're signing off for today. Until next time on Passports, Please.
He'd get home at 5:30, fix his drink, sit down in his chair, pick a fight with mama, complain about us kids getting in his hair. At night he'd sit alone and smoke. I'd see his frown behind his lighter's flame. Now that same frown's in my mirror. Got my daddy's blood inside my veins. Fish swim.